From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will do our best to get you updated on the news that made headlines this week. And today, our panel includes Ian Mack Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Hi, everybody. Happy Friday.
Hi.
Happy Friday.
Melissa, I would like to start with you, and let's talk about where we are in terms of fire season here in Idaho. I know you've got the latest on two of the big fires, the lava fire and the Wapiti fires. Can you tell us what's going on and what people need to know?
Absolutely. We'll start with the lava fire, which is the one by Lake Cascade, so near Donley, just south of McCall. Earlier this week, that prompted a lot of evacuations on the west side of the lake. And if you're not familiar with that area, there are some vacation homes over there, but there are also a lot of residential homes. There are a lot of locals who live there year round. And so several people had to evacuate. The fire grew at an alarming rate. It overtook one of the fire camps where the firefighters were actually set up. Thankfully, nobody was injured in that. It also merged with another existing fire called the Boulder Fire. So it was an alarming situation, especially looking at the weather forecast for the week, knowing that those storms were coming through on Wednesday. Ultimately, there was some growth, but the cool weather also worked in the firefighters' favor. Some of those evacuation orders have been downgraded from go now to, you know, you can go back to your homes for the moment, just be ready to leave again. So people have been able to get back to their property. I'm seeing on social media that there were some livestock losses, unfortunately, near Ola, which is always unfortunate. But for the most part, these firefighters have done just a phenomenal job with a really chaotic and very stressful situation, and helped save, you know, not just property, but also a lot of folks' lives with their good communication and their quick evacuation orders.
So that's the latest on the lava fire. Do we know about containment with that at all, Melissa? Especially as you said, it kind of merged with the Boulder fire.
It's about 95,000 acres right now. And I think I saw that it's at 6% containment. But remember, putting out the fire at this point isn't the only goal. There's, you don't want it to spread. And so there's a lot of work that they do to work on the front lines and make sure that there isn't a lot of fuel where the fire is about to advance. So containment isn't the only measure of how they're doing. Again, the cold weather has also worked in their favor. And so it's not just that the fire hasn't been put out. It also hasn't grown as much as it could have.
And then where are we in terms of the, excuse me, of the Wapiti fire, Melissa, and remind us where that is again?
The Wapiti fire is in the Sawtooths over by Stanley. You know, so Loman to Stanley and just south of Highway 21, is where that is. It got a lot of the old, forest in that area that wasn't hit by the big fire in 2012. There were still a lot of dead trees, very dense, that were dead because of beetle infestations. And so it was just waiting to burn. It was just a matter of time. It prompted a couple of weeks ago a lot of evacuations west of Stanley. There was also a point where it really looked like the town of Stanley was in danger, and that they would have to evacuate. Again, great work by the crews there. Quick work to hold the line, to get rid of fuel before the fire reached that point. Highway 21 between Loman and Stanley is still closed because of fire danger and also because of flood danger. You know, remember, the trees and vegetation don't do a lot of work to keep the soil from sliding. And when you get a huge influx of moisture like we got, you know, it's good in that the temperature works in our favor to keep the fire from growing, but that moisture can also make the soil a lot heavier, and it can cause some landslides. And so That highway is still closed, but most people have been able to return to their homes and their properties. The weather was pretty cold overnight. There was some moisture, not enough to be clear to put out the fire, but enough that it helped tamp down the growth. It's at about 125,000 acres right now. And we're not at the end, but hopefully the end is in sight. For people who want updates, again, I've mentioned this before on your show, but idahofire.org, Zeb Palmer is a fantastic resource for people who want some of the nitty-gritty details about how the weather and the firefighting resources are all coming together to affect how managers are approaching these fires.
Okay, thanks for that, Melissa. Ian, you recently wrote a story about how Tamarack has been impacted by some of these fires. In fact, they had to close down for a time. Walk us through that. What happened?
Yeah, so as Melissa was just outlining, there have been some fast-moving developments on these central Idaho fires over the past few days. Tamarack, the popular mountain resort and destination that's west of Lake Cascade near Donnelly and south of McCall, announced on Tuesday of this week that they were going to have to shut down because of those nearby evacuations and the threats of the lava fire to the south that Melissa was just talking about. So they started to send guests home on Tuesday and shut down all of their resort operations. But then shortly after that, yesterday, the resort announced that due to the improved fire conditions, the rain that they've gotten and that we've gotten here in Boise too, and the colder weather, the conditions had improved enough that they felt comfortable reopening and allowing guests to return. And so the resort's opening back up today. And I think, you know, it remains to be seen what these fires are going to do over the coming days. I saw in the forecast for Cascade and Stanley areas, there's more rain that's supposed to come early next week, and colder temperatures as well. And so it's possible that this turn in the weather that's been in the firefighters' favor will continue and hopefully keep these fires from growing any further. And I also saw in an update today the Wapiti fire near Stanley, that they did have to ground their aircraft that they use with their firefighters there to help bring water to the fires because of the cloudy weather, but that the cloudy weather is supposed to clear this afternoon. And so they're hoping to get those planes flying again to help with the firefighting efforts.
But I mean, Ian, the fact that Tamarack did close down even for a short amount of time, you know, I don't remember the last time we saw something like this, where we saw these, you know, big resorts or things like that taking these precautions. But I think that just shows us, I mean, how big these fires are and how much they're impacting, you know, these towns.
Yeah, they're huge fires around the central part of the state. Tens of thousands of acres have burned and still are burning or under threat. And so it's definitely been I'd say a very serious fire year for Idaho and for the state.
Yeah.
And remember, it's not just about the danger from the fire itself. It's also, as we've all experienced, regardless of where we are in the state at different points of the summer, the air quality is dangerous during some of these events. And it's not just miserable and it makes us feel gross. For some people, it's actually dangerous. And so that factors into some of those decisions too. But again, hopefully the fire season isn't over, but hopefully the end is in sight with some of these cooler weather events.
No, agreed, Melissa. Just having that even that one day this week of cooler weather, I mean, that impact that it has on the fire season, kind of starting to see an end to it, I think is just a huge. So appreciate all of those updates on where we are in the fire season. Don, Boise Dev did a story about an investigation into a firearms training business in the Boise foothills. They might not be, is it operating legally?
Oh, yes. The Facebook comments have been debating all week if legal is the correct term here or not, but here's what's happening.
Okay, good to know.
There is a business called Valiance Firearms Training. It started up fairly recently by a Boise State grad who had studied entrepreneurship. They have an Instagram page that shows people up there doing training. It's off of Cartwright Road, not too far from Hidden Springs, which I think is part of the challenge here. We'd gotten a couple emails from people kind of wondering what had happened. And when we checked in with the county, it's important to note, and this is something people, I think, miss, because you say the Boise foothills. This isn't mm-hmm. in Boise. It's in unincorporated Ada County. And so this is under the jurisdiction of the county. And we found out that they are doing some investigation into what's happening here, because the property does not have a conditional use permit, certainly for shooting ranges. There's actually no real current permits for the property. The owner of the business talked to our reporter, Aaron Banks Rusby, who did great work on the story. And, you know, he was an Army Ranger veteran and said that that service in the military gave him access to learn some of the top tier training in the world when it comes to tactics and firearms. And he called it a passion. You know, certainly shooting ranges are legal, and we have a Second Amendment right to use firearms. But what's at question here is if there's legality to using this property in that way without getting permits. He noted that he didn't own the property and said he couldn't tell us who did. So we went and looked with Yada County, with like every agency in town, it seems like, to figure these things out. Started with the Ada County assessor, who said that it was registered to Seven Gates Investments. When you look them up with the Idaho Secretary of State, that goes to a Meridian post office box and an address for Michael Forsyth with Forsyth Law. Aaron reached out to him and he declined to confirm whether he owns the property or if he is a representative for the property. Sometimes attorneys mm-hmm. Are registered agents for businesses. He sent Aaron an email that says, and I'm going to quote this, quote, "Information about property ownership or entity ownership and use of property is not generally information subject to be released to a reporter, and this does not happen to be an exception." All right. So we did a little digging after the initial reporting here, and there's a very long, wordy paragraph in our story. I'm not going to read it all, although I would like to, because it is very complicated. Needless to say, the property was formerly the ranch of Daryl Forsyth. I've used that name a couple times. And mm-hmm. Mr. Forsyth died in 2017, and his obituary noted that his ranch was located at 15401 Cartwright Road, which is the same address of this shooting range. So what I'm telling you without telling you is that at least at one point, the Forsyth family owned this property. Whether mm-hmm. they do now, they won't confirm it. Part of the issue here is firing ranges are sometimes something that people don't want near their homes because of noise and other questions. There was a proposed 80-acre shooting sports park in Eagle that we reported on a number of times that didn't get permitted because residents were worried about noise and then also potential fire danger from bullets hitting rocks. The city of Eagle did approve that. I misspoke. I said it didn't. Did approve that, but they are still kind of working through some of that. This is also key because folks who have lived here a long time, which is a phrase I feel like I say to Gemma a lot, remember that in 1996, there was a highly uh-huh. visible forest fire. This is the forest fire segment here. This was actually a range fire across the Boise Front. I remember it as a kid growing up here. It burned about 14,000 acres, went all along the foothills. It was very visible, destroyed a home up in the foothills. And that was found to have started from an off-duty police officer using a Boise police firing range. And they were using a tracer bullet, which missed its target, landed in the brush, and ignited the fire. So not just a theoretical concern mm-hmm. as to fire in the foothills. Obviously, tracer rounds and some of the other rounds are different. Tracer rounds ignite after they leave the barrel of a gun. And so obviously, that's different than maybe a lead bullet. We don't know what the outcome of the investigation is, and we'll be watching that to kind of see what happens next here.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting to me, Don, and as you mentioned, it goes back to that 1996 Foothills fire, is that, I mean, especially what we know now about, you know, fires and the susceptibility of it in particular in the foothills, right? And how much growth there has been in the foothills and how many people live there is that there would be a range there. That's just what stood out to me as just a person who lives here that I'm like, wow, is that really where we want to have a firing range?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with firing ranges and people who are operating firearms in responsible ways need to go out and train and learn and work on their marksmanship so that they can, operate them in the way that they wish to. And that's embedded deeply in our country and our culture. It's just a matter of, is this property appropriate? Does the county think it's appropriate and has a permit been given? And I alluded to people saying, you know, is this legal or not? And they're like, well, it's a Second Amendment right. It is, but, there are laws and pieces in place to decide where certain activities can be done, just as, you know, you might not want an apartment complex built next to your house and municipalities get to decide that. You know, it's a bit complicated, and we'll see what happens here. There are certainly firing ranges around our area. That Boise Police fire range that I had mentioned near Fort Boise eventually was moved out of the foothills to an area south of town. I think a lot of people who like to go fire a weapon on the weekend, not speaking personally at all, actually I am, we'll go to the desert and far south of town and find some open land out there. And so that desert area is often a place you see more of this because it is far from homes and far from other people.
Mm-hmm. Before we go into break, Caitlin, Nate Eaton was on last week and told us a little bit about this really dramatic encounter with a grizzly bear with two hunters, but you were actually able to speak with these two hunters as they retold this story. So tell us about this, because I mean, they are lucky to be alive.
Right. They are extremely, extremely lucky to be alive. My coworker, David Pace, was able to contact the two young men that were involved in this situation. Their names are Riley Hill and Braxton Myers. Essentially what happened, what we gathered is that Riley Hill, who is only 20 years old, and his buddy Braxton were up hunting in the Caribou Targhee National Forest almost 2 weeks ago, just west of Henry's Lake in Island Park. They had gone up there to look for elk. They saw that there were some elk on some trail cams, and so they were really excited to go up and start hunting. They ended up going about 30 minutes above the Continental Divide Trail off of Highway 20 and ended up back trailing down the hill on a razor. They ended up parking and hiking a little bit. They said they were like pausing and searching because they didn't want to spook anything. And around 7:20 in the morning, they said they heard a loud thud. They turned around and Braxton ended up seeing his friend yell, "Oh crap, that's a bear," according to him. And they saw the grizzly charging at them on all fours. And he ended up getting attacked. Riley says that he, you know, didn't see him coming. His friend dropped his archery bow and pulled out a 10 millimeter Springfield from his holster and shot the bear once. Nothing happened. And they were only 12 feet apart, these two friends, while one of them was getting, you know, his arm, I guess, is in the bear's mouth, and he was being flung side to side. Just a really, 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 really dangerous situation. Something a lot of people obviously don't really come back from. His friend ended up shooting the bear 24 times. We ended up finding out the bear weighed 530 pounds. And eventually, after 24 shots, they were able to kind of take the bear down. And they shared a really dramatic video with us. It's only about 6 seconds, but it's on our website, of the bear laying there after they had killed it, and then Riley standing there like holding his arm while it's like obviously pretty torn up, and he they're really, really lucky to be alive. It's kind of crazy to hear these kinds of things, because it tends to make me think like, okay, well, how many bears are there? Like, how easy is it to spook a bear up there? And we were actually told by the Idaho Fish and Game Regional Director, Matt Pearson, that there's over 1,000 bears in Island Park right now. And this Wow. particular bear was actually kind of famous in the Island Park area. And a lot of local ranchers called it the King of the Hill. So a lot of the farmers and ranchers have kind of like thanked these kids for essentially taking it out, because it had been eating a lot of the cattle. It had been kind of destroying these farms and these ranches. So the bear was 20 years old, which is a really, really long life for a grizzly in the wild. It actually was missing an ear from a fight that it got in with another animal, which is why it got spooked, because it didn't hear them on one side. And they happened to walk on the side with the bear's good ear. And so it's a really crazy story. David did such an amazing interview with these two boys, and they are very lucky to be alive. I believe one of them is actually getting married in a couple weeks, so they're going to have quite the story to tell during their speeches.
I have to say, it is worth such a read, and it really is just truly incredible that they are both okay. So appreciate that update on them, Caitlin. Ian, I want to dive into a story that involves a Boise man and allegations of terrorism. Talk to us about this, because he was arrested Friday, right? And he's accused of helping to lead an online network. And this is of what would be white supremacist terrorists. And this is like around the globe.
Yeah, these are some really serious allegations. And yes, he was arrested last Friday. His name is Matthew Allison, Boise man. And yeah, I should say, these are, for people listening, these are some serious allegations linked to violent acts of terrorism that I'll be describing. But Allison and an alleged co-conspirator were arrested last Friday for they're being accused of fostering a loosely connected online haven for extremists around the world that federal authorities have directly linked to multiple instances of actual terrorist violence in other countries and on the East Coast of the U.S. So thousands of miles away from where Allison, the Boise man, and this alleged co-conspirator of his who lived in California, where they lived, but they were using these Telegram social media networks. Telegram is a social media app like Twitter or X or Facebook, where they were using group chats and other channels to communicate and encourage violence linked to white supremacy and also anti-LGBTQ, and kind of trying to radicalize people or encourage people who hold those beliefs to do violence and to enact violence in pursuit of those aims. And some of what they're accused of doing is both compiling videos valorizing previous terrorist attacks committed by people with white supremacist views, and also they're accused of also kind of compiling instruction manuals for how to make bombs, how to make chemical weapons, how to commit an act of violence and not get caught. And then also kind of generally in these group chats, encouraging those who are there to commit violence. And so this was a really startling news release that we got last week from federal authorities. It included quotes from the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland and the head of the FBI, Christopher Wray. Some of the acts that these two alleged co-conspirators have been linked to include a teenager in Slovakia in 2022 who killed two people and injured a third in a shooting at an LGBTQ bar in Bratislava, a city there in Slovakia. That attacker had authored a manifesto and sent it to Allison, according to authorities, kind of thanking this group, which was known as, or is known as Terrorgram, which is sort of a combination of terror and the word Telegram, which is the name of this social media app. And then more recently, two attacks this summer, one of them in New Jersey, which didn't actually end up occurring, but there was an 18-year-old there who was arrested for plotting to attack an electrical substation. And this is something that's kind of, you know, I think we've been seeing in different parts of the world recently. It's called accelerationism. It's an effort by some people with white supremacist views to, essentially, they're trying to end society as it is so that they can build a white ethno state. And so for that reason, they, some of them have been targeting electrical infrastructure, other important infrastructure that kind of runs day-to-day life around the globe. So that attack did not occur. This 18-year-old was arrested before before it happened, but he was also linked directly to, through a manifesto, to these two leaders of the online Telegram group. And then lastly, in mid-August, there was a teenager in Turkey who was arrested for stabbing five people outside of a mosque there in a city southeast of Istanbul. And he also wrote in his manifesto that he had used Telegram's documents to plan his attack. That's sort of a lot of what was laid out in this criminal indictment. And my colleague, Nicole Blanchard, she's been also leading our coverage on this. And she attended this week Allison's first hearing in federal court in Boise, where he was read the 15 charges against him by a judge. And he'll also be appearing next week for a follow-up hearing about whether he'll be kept in jail while these while this case against him proceeds. And some additional news that my colleague Nicole reported that came out of this more recent hearing was that Allison, when he was arrested, officers found with him, he was arrested with a backpack containing zip ties, duct tape, a gun, ammunition, a lockpicking kit, and a knife. And they said that he also had what they called a go bag in his apartment containing $1,500 in cash, a passport, a birth certificate, more ammunition, and a face covering linked to a neo-Nazi white supremacist group. And they also, federal authorities also said in their recent filing that he had actually confessed to some of the crimes during questioning after his arrest. That was also included in some of the court documents. But that's kind of the outline of the case here. And he'll be back in court next week.
All right. Well, thanks for that update, Ian. As you said, it was, I think we were all shocked when we learned about this. Caitlin, Wednesday marked 23 years since 9/11. And you recently wrote about a new memorial in Idaho Falls. Tell us about this.
Right. So it was actually my coworker, Andrea Olson. She attended the dedication for a new 9/11 memorial at the Idaho Falls Fire Department Station 1. There was a group of retired New York firefighters there as well. Something that's really special about this is that the memorial is a 12-foot tall statue of stainless steel and granite with water flowing down. It's really, really beautiful. But the special part is that each of the towers have a piece of steel that was salvaged from the collapsed World Trade Center towers that the Idaho Falls Fire Department actually acquired over 10 years ago. The fire department and a local landscape artist, Nate Dershey, brought kind of this whole thing to fruition. He has built quite a few really well-known statues in Idaho Falls, including an eagle statue called the Protector in Idaho Falls, and the rock gardens by the Pancarry Bridge. Those are both his work, and a lot of places around town helped to get this work, to get this kind of put up here. Heroes Defense, which is a local nonprofit organization, fully funded the display, the memorial. They hold a 9/11 tribute banquet every year to raise money to help first responders. That was actually last weekend, but it's a really cool kind of thing. We don't have a 9/11 memorial really anywhere close in Idaho Falls. So this is kind of a nice place for people to go by and kind of pay their respects around 9/11. And it actually illuminates itself at night. So when you drive by, it's all lit up and really pretty. They're also planning on putting some plaques on it in the coming months. But it's really beautiful. It's something that I think, I'm not sure if I already said this or not, but over 100 people showed up on Wednesday to help dedicate it, which was really, really special.
Well, thanks for the update on that. I did see the pictures of it. It really is a beautiful memorial. So Don, your Margaret Carmel had a really interesting story recently about some new apartments that will be going up near the Boise airport. But we should note the airport director had an objection to this.
I'm just here to tell you about all the good work my amazing teammates do this week. And Margaret Carmel,
hey, good.
You know, we got good people here, as many outlets do. So Boise developer Hawkins, formerly Hawkins Companies, has approved an apartment complex. Pretty common. In fact, I'm writing a story about an apartment complex by Hawkins right now. So they're doing a bunch of them around the area. This one would be located on Maple Grove, just south of Overland in Boise, if you're familiar with the area. It's going to be 174 units. Ultimately, it's been approved, but as you alluded to, Gemma, there was some question. Boise Airport Director Rebecca Hupp was not in favor of this being approved and said that it really shouldn't be. The site is in what's called the airport influence area, and that is kind of a bubble around the airport, particularly in the jet path, that has some special rules that cap how much density can be there. And as Margaret so eloquently said, it was a sticky wicket for city staff and a couple of the council members. Essentially, the Hupp was saying that at 28 units per acre, that's too much of a departure from what the airport influence area's requirements are of 5 units per acre. So that's a pretty typical kind of 80s, 90s development for houses around here. 5 units per acre is, I think, fairly typical for some of the older neighborhoods. You don't really see that now even in single family neighborhoods. And part of that is because for the airport area, part of it is the more houses you put in, the more chances you are of having complaints. So the council batted this back and forth a little bit, and there was one member who had recused herself, Kathy Cordless, who actually represents that area, because she said she'd given feedback during the neighborhood meeting process. And Mayor McLean was absent this week because she is out of the country on vacation. And so it was down to the remaining 5 council members, and they voted 3-2 to go ahead and approve this. Mostly on the need for additional housing. What's kind of interesting here is that Councilmember Colin Nash, who ultimately voted for the project, noted that, you know, we went through this fairly large rewrite of Boise's zoning code and didn't address this. This wasn't something that was really talked about. They left this fairly restrictive set of covenants in place on the area. And Nash criticized the process that led to the application. He said that the city had signaled to the developer that it would be willing to bend those rules and allowed them to go through a conditional use permit process. And then at the end kind of said, well, we don't think that we should do this. And he pointed out that there's actually kind of a bunch of things that weren't done in that zoning code process, which was a long grinding process. And there are some other things that really should have been addressed and weren't. We have our eye on this because the city has said they will make changes to the zoning code again coming up late this year. And so we're kind of working on that right now. City Council member Lucy Willits, who ultimately voted to... I'm sorry. Against. I'm having to read it. Yeah. So she said, you know, I've always said the city ordinances aren't the Ten Commandments. They're not written in stone. They're meant to be revised. But this is a pretty major policy change. She pointed out that the zoning code had 4 days of people who testified and they didn't fix this. She said they need to be careful because we're trying to thread a needle because we're so desperate for housing that we're not able to make this work in the current setup that it is. So this is kind of one of those where the city's got itself at a spot here where they've done this big zoning code rewrite. And now we're saying, well, yeah, but we don't like this, so we're going to bend the rules. And that was what the zoning code rewrite was supposed to guard against, too many exceptions. And here we are just a few months in having a fairly major exception. Frankly, there's some others working their way through the works. So ultimately, this is being allowed to move forward, but airport, not happy.
Caitlin, what is this about jelly beans and a 4th of July parade?
Right. There's always got to be one really weird story. So
yeah.
Essentially what happened is in the 4th of July parade in Pocatello, there were a bunch of rumors that people handing out candy to children were giving out jelly beans that contained THC. The Pocatello Police Department at the time sent out a release that said that someone received candy during the 4th of July parade, and after consuming part of a jelly bean, believe it may have contained THC. They reported it to the police, and after doing some investigating, they found out that the jelly beans that were being given out were in the third party packaging. So they essentially collected a bunch of samples and sent them to the Idaho State Lab to be tested to see if they actually had THC in them. It was a really big kind of social media hullabaloo at the time. Mm-hmm. People were really worried about things they were getting in their candy. So this week, I believe on Tuesday, the Pocatello Police Department came out and said they determined there were no drugs found in the candy at the 4th of July parade. There's really no explanation why this person felt dizzy and lightheaded after eating half of the jelly bean, but people were really relieved to hear that, yeah, probably all the sugar, maybe. A little bit of a sugar high. But that's the good news, is there was no drugs in the jelly beans.
That is honestly good news, especially, I mean, in all seriousness, especially when, you know, you're giving this stuff to your kiddos and all of that. So
right.
Yes, it's kind of a crazy story, but good that they did the investigation and found that everything is fine. So no, as I appreciate that update. Dawn, I want to wrap up with some restaurant news. In particular, up in McCall, a really well-known longstanding restaurant is up for sale. I have to say, both of my sisters-in-law worked at this restaurant back in college. My husband used to go to this restaurant when he would have time off when he was fighting fires in the summers during college. I mean, a lot of history. So we're talking about Lardo's, but tell people about this.
Yeah, a couple of items from our Boise Dev Eats newsletter. This one, actually, a shout up the radio dial. Michelle Hart at Light FM actually noticed this first. This Lardo's has been around since 1973, named for the one-time mining town of Lardo. If you are in the know, you know why it's called that. And yeah, it's for sale. It's been the same family for all these decades. And the Brundage Realty, which is actually kind of a major residential realtor up there, has it listed for $2.3 million. It includes mm-hmm. the restaurant, the land, the building, and the liquor license. You know, the flyer's written in such a way that certainly somebody could walk in and continue to operate Lardo's, but it's also written in such a way that if you were interested in the property, which is right by Shore Lodge and or mm-hmm. the liquor license, you could kind of split it off that way. So what the future is, we don't exactly know for now. And, you know, McCall's been through this a little bit. The Pancake House kind of went through similar things. Really, honestly, over several years, they tried and tried and tried to sell the Pancake House. Were unsuccessful ultimately and sold the property and building to a, you know, grocery store and it closed. So we don't know what's next for Lardo's, but we do know that there's movement there and we'll keep watching that.
Well, and also Bistro 45 closed this month, didn't it? And it had been an operation.
Closing.
Oh, it's closing. Okay.
I think there's one more weekend. Yeah. But it is about to close or has closed. How about that? Yeah. Bistro 45, which has been around for 20 years up there first, well, it's actually been in a couple spots, but most famously probably below Salmon River Brewing on Railroad Avenue. It moved last winter. Chef Stephen Topple purchased that, moved it into his Ragazza del Lago location on the lake, and after kind of one summer season, decided to take a job as the executive chef at Tamarack and decided to close that down. And so that's closing up shop. And so we've, you know, seen some shifts. I didn't put this in the article, but it is important. The labor market up there is continues to be very strained, and that is tied directly to the housing market, which is very strained. And it's hard for these restaurateurs to find staff. Ultimately, that's what the Pancake House's owners said, that they just, it was too hard to staff anymore. And so you're seeing that it's a place a lot of people go, but there's fewer and fewer locals who can afford to live there, and it causes a strain on places to eat out. And we're seeing some effects of that, whether that's involved in Lardo's, I can't say. But I do know that that has been an impact on a lot of restaurants, because it's a hard business to be in anywhere. It's especially hard in a resort town with escalating housing prices.
Yeah. I've got about 3 minutes left on, so I do want to also talk about another restaurant, this time, though, in downtown Boise, because there's going to be a new Japanese restaurant opening. And can I just tell you, thank goodness for your Boise Dev Eats, because I cannot keep up with every new restaurant that is opening in the Treasure Valley. I mean, I'm not even joking. It's crazy how many are opening. And here is another one coming on the scene.
It is a lot. And my partner, my wife and partner, Kara Jackson, launched Boise Dev Eats earlier this summer. And the newsletter goes out each Thursday and has been really popular. And one of the stories this week that we had was this new forthcoming sushi restaurant downtown. Edward Higgins, who is the executive chef at The Lively, who has a pedigree of stops at a number of Four Seasons resorts around the world, including in California and in Hawaii, he's the chef, executive chef at The Lively. And one of the concepts that he and partner Greg Strimple have been working on is a new fairly high-end sushi place. This would go in the 4th and Idaho building downtown. And you're like, what building?
Yeah, I know. I'm like,
Yeah. That's the under-construction condo project that's going to happen.
Oh, right.
There, yeah. Not too far from St. Luke's, about 3 or 4 blocks from St. Luke's. This restaurant isn't going to open until 2026 because the building still has to be built. But they're planning to kind of ground this in Higgins' experience in Tokyo. There's a restaurant that he really liked in the Ginza region, and this would pair fish and sushi products brought in from the fish markets in Japan.
Wow. So
flown in by jet over that apartment complex. And it would also include beef from Snake River Farms here, but then also like Japanese Wagyu type beef. They're still working on the design, but he really wants to kind of, like I said, ground this in a kind of traditional Tokyo styling. And so this we're looking at for the first quarter of 2026, first or second quarter, early 2026. So something to look forward to in the downtown scene, but it's fun to tell you about something really early on in the process. Doesn't have a name yet, but we'll be watching for that in coming months and years, frankly, too.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. And you know what? That just means there's 2 more years as we talk about more restaurants coming into town. Oh, so with all that said, I want to thank all of you so much for spending your Friday noon hour with us. We appreciate you. We've been talking with Ian Mac Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Melissa Davlin, who is the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.